Blog Talk Radio.
Government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
Top politics. We are going to be talking tonight about leftist tactics, really, and just all kinds of leftist tactics, whether it be electioneering or, you know, who gets kicked out of Comic-Con. That's kind of what we're going to talk about tonight. So we're going to have some politics at the beginning and some Gamergate at the end, and probably some, you know, dumb tweets from political figures in the middle. Namely Hillary Clinton. I think we're actually going to make a move from, for a long time I did, you know, John Kerry's dumb tweet of the week. And lately all he's doing is posting pictures of himself glad-handing other diplomats. And, you know, while that's entertaining, you really can't do much with that except, you know, remind people that he looks like Lurch. But that, and that aside, someone who is tweeting some really, really stupid stuff is the Hillary Clinton campaign. And they have really done a great job of making her look, well, like Hillary Clinton. So we're going to be talking about that a little bit later. But first, we're going to talk, leftist tactics with my friend Brandon Darby, who knows them better than anyone else because he used to use them. So Brandon, you want to tell everybody a little bit about yourself so they kind of know who you are? I mean, I know people have heard your name before, and but not everybody knows kind of how you got into conservative politics.
Well, it's kind of a long story. You know, how I got into conservative politics, it's something that I actually talk about a lot when I travel around to different groups, usually Tea Party groups or other conservative groups. But it, you know, it was a long time coming. A lot of experiences in my life, in the, you know, the aftermath of Katrina and things I experienced in Venezuela, and things, just life experiences that led me to begin questioning, you know, left of center practices, basically, or left of center theories and ways of doing things. But ultimately, long story short, is I ended up working undercover with the FBI and got to participate in some efforts with the FBI to stop, to stop violence against Israeli citizens, and then B, to stop violence against law enforcement and conservatives in the U.S. And to make a long story short, I got attacked viciously in media, left-of-center media led by the New York Times, really took the side of the bomb makers and attacked me. And long story short, I got attacked a lot. Then Andrew Breitbart heard something on NPR where I was getting attacked, and he was able to contact me and ask me to fight back with him. And then he began the long process of really fighting back and helping me reclaim my name from a lot of the attacks and the smears that had happened in media. And I had a pretty good idea of how media works just from having lived each moment and watching the step-by-step progression of how they very carefully crafted and shifted a narrative, oftentimes contradicting themselves, but still crafting and shifting a narrative to destroy me and ultimately to attack, you know, because I fell into a larger picture, which was leftists hating law enforcement. And they began, they had an opportunity to attack law enforcement through me, and they did. And that was the personal cost that I paid in that was very high. And if it weren't for Andrew, I would have really not had much of a voice to fight back with. So, you know, I began to, you know, basically the process of identifying other people who were going through the same thing and trying to help them fight back. And that's kind of the approach that I generally take most of the time it involves conservative politics or people involved in conservative movement who I think are being smeared by media, and I help them, but not all of the time. You know, like some of the stuff we do, you know, there's people in Mexico, for instance, who are citizen journalists, and they report on cartels and on corruption in their communities, right? They're trying to better their own communities, not come here and leave their community, but actually better their own communities. And so we have a project called Cartel Chronicles where on Breitbart, Texas, where we've actually hired and brought on some of these Mexican writers to help them have a bigger voice against the cartel. So sometimes, most of the time, it manifests as us defending conservatives, but sometimes it just manifests with us helping fight bullies and helping people who are trying to tell the truth.
Well, that's interesting. So I actually was looking at your Twitter feed earlier today, and actually that was what made me think of talking to you this week, is the gentleman who attacked you a few days ago with saying that, well, obviously, if you only just became a conservative, you're not a real conservative. And that, first of all, I mean, that strikes me as a little bit odd because, I mean, and somebody else mentioned later in the feed, I don't know if you were still tagged, that, you know, when Jesus was on the cross, the guy next to him was saved and he repented right there. I mean, this is, you can't say that the later conversion isn't a real conversion, or, you know what I'm saying? And so it's just,
well, it's tricky, right? Because
yeah.
There's people, I mean, like, it would have been nice to have been raised with parents who taught me about conservative values, but I didn't have that, you know? I've had a different experience
right.
in my life, and a lot of my politics and a lot of how I looked at stuff came from my experiences as a youth. Like when I was 13 and 14, I was a runaway, and I, you know, somehow made it through that experience. But obviously I leave that, and I have a strong distaste for people who abuse power, who take advantage of other people. Well, I had a strong passion for helping others, and the way we are currently structured is generally, if you're really radical about helping other people, you're going to fall into left of center people, because they're the ones who get very radical about doing it usually. And that's another longer story, but they're the ones who generally do that you come across in day-to-day society when you're involved in nonprofits, even though nonprofits and that whole nonprofit industrial complex is funded primarily with conservative dollars. It's primarily run and operated not only with left of center people at the helm, but also with left of center methodologies behind how they do things. You know, you fall into that. And so my experiences about becoming a conservative happened over the course of a lifetime, you know, like things I began to realize in my efforts to help other people, and things I began to see that didn't work and things that did work. And then now coming to accept that, wow, I had, you know, everybody around me was right. I actually am pretty conservative or libertarian leaning. That was something that came later on in life. But the process of realizing who I am and growing and maturing, that's something that happened over the course of life. So I reject that person's notion that, like, oh, you just became a kid. It's like, no, I didn't at all, actually. And that's not really how that works. It's something that, you know, conservatives are so dehumanized and by media
yeah.
and by culture and in the nonprofit world. And it takes a long time before you know, if you're from that world, before you can go, wow, you know, like, I really actually am pretty damn conservative. And in fact, you know, some of these people I deal with are actually kind of dangerous. And it takes a, you know, becoming conservative over time as you grow, and then finally come to the point where you actually acknowledge to yourself and then to the world that that's where you stand. That those aren't the same things, you know, at
right.
all. And to me, it's just kind of, You know, and that's kind of the same experience as Andrew Breitbart had, and it's similar experiences that others had. It's just not an instant thing. And I think people like that, you know, like somebody gets their feelings hurt and you know, they say something rude. But I was looking at some of those people's Twitter feeds, and that's just kind of how they interact with everyone. I really don't think it's a personal thing, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that you would say that it's a whole lifetime of experiences that kind of led you down this road. Because I will say that, you know, the only things I knew about politics growing up is that my parents really liked Ronald Reagan, and my mom didn't trust Bill Clinton at all. And so, I mean, my family was really conservative, but I didn't really take the journey myself until I was in the military. And so here I am, I'm an adult. The only thing I had voted in one presidential election, and for me that was 2000. And for me it was an easy decision to make, because I'm looking back on it, and I kind of was still leaning on my parents' politics and saying, okay, well, I know this about Al Gore. He's probably going to be, you know, a little bit of an extension of the Clinton administration, and we don't really trust Bill Clinton. And I understood enough about the scandals that I didn't trust him, so it wasn't just, oh, my mom doesn't trust him. And I knew that George W. Bush was pro-life, and that's always been a personal issue for me. And so I was like, okay, I went into that, and I have never regretted casting that vote, even though I could have been more educated going in. I think I still would have made the same decision. And so I kind of, you know, I started getting involved there, but then I joined the military, and I started paying more attention because these people were controlling my job. And so it became a little bit more of an issue for me. It hit a little closer to home when different, you know, new rules of engagement became a problem for my friends and things like that. But it is interesting to see that, because I don't think anybody really starts out. I mean, you may have a background that pushes you toward conservatism, but I don't really think anybody can say, well, I've been conservative my whole life. You have to learn it and take the step somewhere. If that makes
right,
sense.
Right. And yeah, totally. And, you know, a lot of it too, I think, just kind of looking back on stuff, it's, you know, someone said to me the other day, they said, you know, who do you like which of the candidates do you like? And I said, well, I think they all have value, and I think they'd all do a better job than who's in there now, you know, or who the Democrats will run next. But, you know, personally, I feel very fond towards Ted Cruz. And in fact, I try to not like let that come across in my coverage of stuff, you know, but that's how I feel, I guess, personally. Right now, that's who I like him as a person, you know, and I like
right.
a lot of the things he'll say. I like a lot of the domestic stuff that Rand Paul says, right? And then someone said, well,
right.
that's a pretty far jump from being a leftist years ago to being Ted Cruz. And I'm like, well, it really isn't, because even when I was a leftist, I really wasn't so much of a leftist. I just didn't know that. I was just radical about helping people, because even then, like in the aftermath of Katrina,
right.
I talked about that, and I argued with people all the time. And in interviews, that's all I ever talked about, was like solidarity, not charity. And like, what does that mean? I'm like, we don't want the federal government's help. The federal government helping people is what made them dependent, and what helped for, you know, to create a scenario like what we currently have. The government is unable to help, and we need communities to get together and work together. I mean, those are conservative values. Those are right of center values. But I was saying that as a
right.
leftist, thinking that I was a leftist. So was I really so left? You know, it's like, I don't think so. I just, like I said, I was obviously from being a runaway and then having made it through that time in my life where a lot of people really didn't make it through that time in their life, you know. Obviously, I mean, you can imagine it without me going off into it, like all the things that happened to you as a 13-year-old you know, runaway in Houston, Texas,
mm-hmm.
and a 14-year-old runaway, and you end up with this massive problem with bullies and this massive problem with people who take advantage of other people, you know? And so to me, with my very militant attitude about people who abuse others and who are bullies, it was just natural that I fell in with these other people who were that way. And at the time, the only people who were really that way, you know, this was pre-Andrew Breitbart, like many years ago. And so, you know, I'm 38 now, and this would have been in my teens, right? And in my teens and early 20s, you know, the only people who were really militant about fighting against bullies and had a good message that really focused on those in need were people on the left. Now, I since have learned that that's not the truth and that there's a lot of people on the right who do a whole heck of a lot to help other people. But I bought into the dominant narrative that is prevalent in society, and that I think that we as the right don't do much to help, which is that if you want to help other people, you need to be with liberals or with the left, you know. But none of the things I really espoused were really that leftist, you know. Like I was very anti-military and anti-police, and I blamed the U.S. for a lot of the world's problems, but that was because all of my heroes were leftists at the time and radicals, and because that was the worldview I had been taught in my teens, and that's the worldview I had been taught. And once I got to a point where life experience forced me to challenge those views, you know, and actually, you know, there's a whole series of things that happened that actually very interesting, but I don't want to bore your listeners with this long, detailed story. but basically, there was one law enforcement officer named John Bryson. He later became a chief in the New Orleans Police Department. But he really, you know, I hated the cops. I actually thought they were pigs. I thought that at one time. And this guy made an effort, and instead of being mean to me like all the other cops were, and me being, because I was mean to them, right? Instead of that, he saw that I was helping people, and he said, look, I know you don't like me, and I don't really like you, but you're helping people, and I like to help people, so why don't we help people together? And it was through the process of working with him and getting to know him for the first time, actually getting to know a law enforcement officer, that the dehumanization went away. And when the dehumanization went away, then I began to consider his perspectives and consider that he had a perspective, you know, and that he was a well-intentioned person. And that really broke down a lot in me, and it was something that I had never had, because my whole time as a teen and my whole time, you know, growing up, I didn't have a very favorable view of law enforcement. And so that was something that really broke that down. And over time, you know, I began to have a very big, profound respect. And I began to actually, like, I'm never ashamed of the good stuff I did in New Orleans to help people after Katrina. But I am ashamed of some of my rhetoric, and I am ashamed of the attitudes I had at the time. And I just didn't know better. And as I learned better, you know, I it took a lot of courage to really start to change. But I'm someone like, this is how I was, and I started to change. And ultimately, you know, one thing led to another. You know, the progression of how that would happen, and then how, you know, still considering myself a leftist, but realizing I didn't get along with any leftists. And I really thought, you know, like when the left realized how bad some people on the left were, that they would denounce them and separate themselves, and they didn't, you know, and they actually embraced them and defended them and circled around them, and that's where I really learned a lot of lessons. And then that's when I finally got to a point where I was like, you know, I actually am not these people, you know what I mean? I'm not these people.
Right.
Like, whoever these people are, this is not me. And so you know, the way it happens is just kind of an organic thing. And I think that, you know, most people vote left because most of the people who vote left, they say they vote left because they care about other people. So that narrative, all the way from, you know, back through the, you know, the Bolsheviks, or all the way through, you know, the Soviets' history, and all the way from Venezuela, and what we're seeing now in Venezuela, mm-hmm. and what we saw under Chavez, and also under Cuba. The historically left of center people who want centralized government, they do so. The ruse they use to get in is that they're the ones who care about the downtrodden. They're the ones who care about the poor. They're the ones who care. So that narrative, it wasn't just me who was duped. It's been humanity who's been duped
right.
by that narrative, you know, throughout human history.
Right. And actually, that kind of leads me into one of the things I was going to ask you about. I mean, we've watched kind of an epic fail of a rollout of the Hillary Clinton campaign. I mean, it's been every day there's been a new scandal, and that's not even counting the stuff she had, you know, the baggage she carried when she came into it. And, I mean, I don't know if you've been following this. I mean, first she talked about her immigrant grandparents, except for only one of the three was actually an immigrant.
An immigrant,
and,
right.
And then, you know, and of course she explains it by saying, you know, well, they always talked about immigrants in such a way that, you know, it made me feel like they were immigrants. Well, nobody believes this, but everybody's excusing it. Well, you know, obviously she's under stress and et cetera and whatever, but she's just not a good campaigner. And I was actually talking to Stephen, my producer, before the show about, you know, I almost wonder if she's doing it at this point to prove that she can do that, that she can be this bad and the American people will still vote for her anyway. Because she's going to she's going to protect the women, and she's going to, I mean, that's how I feel about the current president. Sometimes, you know, you have to look at the things he's doing and say, he's just doing it to thumb his nose at us and say, you elected me, I can do it if I want to. And so
I don't think that's the case.
What's going on?
No, I think what's going on with the Clintons is it's kind of weird that no one really talks about it this way, but I mean, like, look at what they had. They had, you know, they had Sidney Blumenthal. Tim Russert. They really had the media complex under control. I mean, they had their allies in the media complex back before, you know, back at the very infant stages of the internet. And so whenever
right.
the Lewinsky scandal broke, all of us walked away thinking, why are we talking about some guy's sex life? And we didn't realize that that was a media campaign developed that all of the left media began to say on the same day at the same time, thus manipulating the minds of everyone. We didn't know that.
Right.
But maybe you did, but I didn't. But I remember I was 19 when that was going on, and I remember actually thinking that and thinking that was my original thought. And it wasn't until later that I did a media analysis talking to Andrew right then, actually, that I began to realize how I had been duped, right? So they're used to having the media complex and being able to operate in a day and age whenever everything they say can't be fact-checked and crowdsourced by the right internet at all, right, and as a whole. They're used to having that. So in her mind, she still operates as though she has that, and she hasn't been able to come to grips with the fact that she doesn't exist in that day and age anymore, where even if the media protects her, there's still millions of people on the internet who can dig and find stuff and find out the truth. And in her mind, she hasn't accepted
right.
that yet. So that's kind of what I think is going on with her. She hasn't come to grips with the fact that OPPO research is crowdsourced, and that the media as an establishment, you know, the 12 major outlets or whatever, they can't protect her now. And she hasn't accepted that. And so I think that that's one of the things that people miss. And when they try to figure out why would somebody say such stuff and think they can get away with it, is she just hasn't come to grips yet with the fact that she doesn't live in the day and age that we were in with the internet
right.
whenever her husband was in power.
Well, and some of it, I think, is just likability, because realistically, her husband could probably run a similar campaign and still win, because
right.
he still has America convinced that he balanced the budget, even though, you know, that he was dragged kicking and screaming to that budget meeting by Newt Gingrich and a Republican Congress. You know,
right.
America thinks that, you know, obviously the guy at the top, he gets the blame, but he also gets the credit. And
right.
so when you see, you know, the fudge numbers and the budget looks like we're in the black, well, obviously Clinton did it, you know, and the media
right.
made it pretty easy to believe that, because they didn't say, oh, well, Clinton wasn't in favor of it, but Newt Gingrich tied his hands and made him do it. Nobody's going to say that, you know.
Well,
and
right.
so I think that's
definitely
interesting.
Well, I think another part of the issue, though, that we're seeing is, you know, people are convinced that it's right media who's taken down Hillary. And if you really look at it, it's actually kind of, it's really a lot of leftists are taking down Hillary. And so the thing that's going on now is that you know, Hillary, I think Hillary is very far left. I think in relation to the current power structure, I don't think she is. I think she's further left than is acceptable. I think she is far left, but I don't think she's far left in the way she's not as far left in the you know, the movement for peace and justice
right.
that the current power structure is in. And so what you're seeing, as much as conservatives want to say that they're the ones taking her out, what you're really seeing happen is you're seeing the left, who's in positions of power, tearing her down mm-hmm. because she's not left enough for them. And they want to see mm-hmm. they want to see a continuation of their of the movement for peace and justice, global revolution. They want to see that revolution continue as Obama and his camp is doing, and not have a more moderate Democrat, even though she's not moderate, she is more moderate in comparison. And
right.
I think that Hillary's not used to seeing that either. They were pretty far left, I think, when they were in office. And I think it in real terms, but in relative terms, this lady is not what President Barack Obama is and what his camp is. She's not going to put, you know, she's going to pardon the riches, and she's going to pardon. She's not going to pardon Mumia Abu-Jamal. This guy probably will, you know, and that's
right.
the difference. Like I think you're seeing the left really tear her down too. Much as the right tears down a candidate like Jeb Bush, because he's
right.
just not Ted Cruz, he's just not Ted Cruz or Tea Party enough. I think that's what you're seeing
right.
with the Democrats and Hillary right now, and with media and Hillary, and also media is a different position than they were too. Media, I can't say that they're more left than they ever were, but they're more openly left than they ever were right now, and like
oh,
in
absolutely.
A big way, a significant
okay.
way. And they're going to tear her down. They're not going to protect her unless she's their only option. And right now, they don't want her to be their option. They want to get somebody. They want an Elizabeth Warren, or they want someone who's going to continue their movement for, you know, their continuation of the struggle that began in the 60s kind of people. Like, that's what they want. So that's what I think is going
right.
on.
Right. Well, you know, I've been saying, and Dana's been saying for months now, Hillary's not going to be the nominee. I don't think there's no question in my mind. I think she's a lightning rod right now. I don't know that she realizes that she's a lightning rod, and I think she's going to be exceptionally pissed off when she figures it out. But I think that they allowed her to announce because they wanted her to, you know, they wanted her to use up all our ammunition so that they could bring in a dark horse candidate. And, you know, maybe that's Elizabeth Warren, maybe it's not. I've said, you know, a number of times, I think it is. And she's said, you know, repeatedly she's not going to run. But we all remember she also said she was Native American. So I'm not really going to hang my hat on anything that Elizabeth Warren said. But honesty is not, it's not a priority. It's not a value that gets you elected, so why use it? And I do think there's going to be another candidate, and I think they're going to wait until Hillary has been completely ruined before they bring him in.
Before Michelle Obama announces.
Yeah, we talk about Hillary not having. Yeah, I was actually looking at Claire McCaskill did some interview, which. She's only supporting Hillary because she wants a cabinet position. But Claire McCaskill made some announcement about how she was supporting Hillary because obviously the 2008 primary was difficult because, you know, you had to choose between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, and it was horrible because they were both such great people. And, you know, and then she says that, She's supporting Hillary because of all her accomplishments and all of the many great things she's done in all of her positions. And I'm like, so you can't name one. You're going to tell us there are a lot of them, but you can't name one. You know, please. You had this 5-minute interview that you did with, you know, whoever, and you cannot name one single accomplishment. That says a lot. And so we talked about Hillary Clinton's resume and how it she just really doesn't have a resume as a senator, as a first lady. Everything she tried to push as a first lady was nothing because she wanted single-payer health care. That didn't happen. Well, then she goes to work as a senator, and she doesn't really do anything there. And then she, you know, obviously her history as Secretary of State, I mean, everything she touched turned to, you know, disaster. So her resume is awful. But then you talk about Michelle Obama's resume. Well, she's got nice arms, apparently.
I mean, her resume is at least as good as her husband's when he was elected.
This is true as well. This is true as well. But, I will say what I've said before. I'll put my arms up against Michelle Obama's any day. And my qualifications for the presidency. But what do I know,
You
right?
ever thought about that, though? Do you think they would do that? Do you think they would try to do that? Have you ever thought about that?
To run her as...
Yeah.
No, I think that I do not... I don't doubt that she'll run for office somewhere. But I don't think she'll run for the presidency. I would be less surprised if Valerie Jarrett stuck her hat in the ring because, let's face it, she's basically the vice president now. I mean, he's getting more advice from her than he is from anybody else in that administration. And I mean, look,
why does
she have more Secret Service than he does? I mean, Valerie Jarrett's
right.
Secret Service detail is bigger than the president. Why is that? Why does she live in the White House with his family? I mean, there's either something really creepy going on, or she's an unpaid and unelected American official.
Just a hellaciously trusted advisor. I don't know. What a mess. But we'll see what they do. But I think that Clinton's going to have problems from the right, obviously, and I think she's going to have a whole lot of problems from the left. And that's not going to be great. But one of the things that keeps happening, I mean, we'll see, but maybe the powers that be will get sketched by the far left and make sure Hillary gets it. I mean, it's a possibility because sometimes, you know, like I think Romney's probably a very good man, but I don't think he was the best candidate to run at that time. And sometimes the powers that be can do as they wish, regardless of the will of the grassroots or of the typical primary voters. So we'll see what they do. I really don't know, but I do think she's in for a rude awakening, and I do think that she can't, you know, she's out. I won't say outdated, but her ideas about and the way she handles media is outdated, you know. I think that she's in for a rude awakening.
TMZ did a comparison. You should look this up if you haven't seen it. TMZ sent somebody out and they interviewed Rubio and Clinton back to back, and it's hilarious. Because Rubio's talking about what music's on his playlist and you know, why we've got to be, you know, we need a younger voice for the presidency. And Clinton's, like, ignoring the guy and walking away. But you're seeing TMZ do this. They wouldn't have done it to President Obama.
No, they wouldn't have done it to Obama, and they won't do it. They won't do it to whoever the left candidate is, but they'll do it to the moderate left candidate, who really isn't moderate in real terms, but she is in relative terms. What a mess, man, we have. What a mess we're going to have. But it's going to be interesting to see what happens. What are you thinking about on the right? What do you think about the candidates so far?
I'm watching Texas. I was actually going to say that. I'm watching Texas because I really – my heart is with Ted Cruz. I love the things he said. I have a thing about executive experience, though. Not that that's the be-all and end-all, and if Ted Cruz even, I mean, if he makes it out of the gate and he's moving, I'm with him all the way. But I'm also watching Rick Perry because he has completely reinvented himself. I've been watching just the speeches he's been making recently, the statements he's been putting out. He's a different man than he was 4 years ago.
Well, you know,
and I don't know what to expect from him.
Yeah.
But
I think he's very competent, and I think you know, I think he's actually got a shot at this deal. Like I wouldn't have said that a couple of months ago.
Yeah.
I was actually kind of mad at him about some of the border stuff that I didn't.
Yeah.
There's some things I disagreed with him strongly, not on what he said about the border, but what he did about the border,
right.
Texas-Mexico border. But as a whole, I think the guy's got a lot going for him, and I think he's, a very compassionate person. I think Ted Cruz is more of a purist, and I think that I don't think Ted Cruz is inventing himself. I think he's being himself, and I really do. And I always think when I look at the candidates, my own thoughts. I feel like he's being himself, much like Louis Gohmert is himself, right? Like when Louis Gohmert is Louis Gohmert is Louis Gohmert. Ted Cruz is Ted Cruz. I think Rand Paul probably tones down a lot of what he really thinks. I think he probably
absolutely.
Has a lot of similar views to things that his dad has, and I think he learns how to tone it down, which is to me a little concerning. And I think Harry, in reinventing himself, is a great way to put it. But I don't know that I don't know that I'm so interested in leaders who realize themselves don't work, so they invent themselves to be another. I don't know that I like that.
Right.
And I'm not sure. I don't know that that's a fair thing to say. I think it might be. And I'm still a little burned on the border stuff. You know, when we had a crisis on the border that I had worked for years to bring attention to. And Rick Perry came out and said, you know, we're securing the border. Texas is doing it. And he really, there's five border patrol sectors in Texas, and he only sent National Guardsmen and DPS to one border patrol sector. And it wasn't until he got out of office that the current governor, Abbott, began to expand that program and send them into other sectors where they were needed. So when he came out and did that, really what it did was it made people think the issue was getting handled. And it took about half of the steam out of the movement to actually provide security between the ports of entry. And it really pissed me off because it's an issue that I care so much about. And I wasn't really happy. So the last couple of times I was in an event at events where I was within feet of former Governor Perry, I actually didn't say hi to him. I was really mad at him. So maybe maybe I'm allowing that one issue to, because I mean, he really did do amazing stuff, and he also did amazing stuff in Texas that people don't even know about. Like, this guy did amazing stuff with drug courts, you know, like for instance, drug courts where people, you know, who were convicted, it's arguable to say victimless, but people who were convicted of crimes that didn't involve a direct victim or violence, a lot of them got to rehabilitate their lives and not go into the prison system, which not only saved Texas a lot of money, but did a lot of good for families. You know, there's no telling how many thousands of children whose parents got better and didn't go into the prison system because of Rick Perry. So, I mean, like, I look at stuff like that, and the guy just impresses the hell out of me. So I guess I can't agree with everything about everyone. So I, like I said, I think he has some promising traits.
Well,
about him.
He's definitely one to watch. That's kind of where I am with it. You know, there's some, I have issues with everybody, I think, minor issues here and there with all of the candidates that have kind of made rumblings about running. So, but, you know, you don't get a perfect candidate unless you run yourself, and I'm not doing that. So, I'm going to have to break in here because we've got another guest on the line. We're going to talk a little bit about Gamergate for the rest of the show. But I want to thank you for coming on and for talking to us. You are welcome to call in anytime. You know, anytime you want to talk about what's going on in Texas, and we'd love to have you. But thanks again.
Yeah,
for coming on.
Call me anytime.
Have a great night.
Thanks for having me. What a great show. Thank you.
Sure.
Bye.
All right, Hammy, you can go ahead with your spot real quick, and then we'll bring Ashley on right after.
You're listening to the alternative source of news, talk, and music for today's unconventional conservatives. This is AltCon Radio.
Welcome back. we are now going to be talking to Ashley Phoenix, who, let's see, that's at A-S-H-P-N-X on Twitter. And we're talking about Gamergate because we've talked about it before. We had a great conversation with Brandon Morse and Adam Baldwin a couple of months ago now. And we were talking about what was going on, just kind of some dirty dealings in gaming journalism, and then we didn't hear about it for a while. And of course, it was still going on in social media. I've been following it a little bit myself, and then all of a sudden, Twitter blew up this weekend because something happened at the Calgary Expo. So, Ashley, you want to kind of I've been reading up about it, but I think that you probably know more about it than I do. If you want to kind of give us an overview of what actually happened at Calgary Expo.
All right. What happened is, of course, I should say that Twitter blows up every weekend with Gamergate because it's constant. And what happened at Calgary Expo is there's a group of mostly women called the Honey Badger Brigade. And these people have been very pro-Gamergate. They're part of a men's rights activist. They're anti-feminist. And they went and got an exhibitor booth at Comic-Con, and they paid for it and everything. And a lady named Allison Tiemann, I believe I pronounced her last name correctly, is a comic book writer, and she also created this Honey Badgers Brigade. And she was there to sell her comic book, and they also sold some merchandise that had the Gamergate logo on everything. And everything was going smooth, and her and another Honey Badger by the name Sage went to a Q&A session about women in comics, which she had every right to go because she's a 7-year veteran of being a woman in comics. And they asked a question, and Allison asked if they were fielding it to the audience. They said yes, gave her permission to speak, and so she spoke and basically gave her reason of why she's not a feminist. And she was very polite. We have it online exactly. You can hear it anybody can hear it for themselves of what happened. And later she goes back to her booth and is pulled away by the event staff. And they pull her away from the other Honey Badgers. Two, she had apparently a recording device in her hand, and they made sure that she wasn't recording and got rid of the device to tell her that she was permanently banned from Calgary Expo for harassment. And that's a rather big deal because it's not just Calgary Expo, which is one of the biggest comic cons in Canada, but any other event related to this. And for a comic book writer that lives off of these events to go to and to sell their merchandise, that's a really big deal.
Right.
And the claim of harassment, we looked at Calgary Expo's frequently asked questions into their harassment, what qualifies as harassment. And under that list, they have criticism. They construe criticism to be harassment. So any dissenting opinion is considered harassment and can get you banned.
Well, that's awesome.
And that's what happened. And
yeah.
So Twitter
hey,
blew
you
up.
You disagreed with us. Go home.
It's pretty much what happened. And she's a warrior, but this even broke her. And, I mean, it breaks a lot of us because this is not the first time. And it's a power struggle, and I know you've kept up with it, and I don't know if your listeners have kept up with it. But constantly for 8 months now, Gamergate has consisted of a wide group of people. It's a very inclusive group, politically, religiously, man, woman, transgender, black, white, yellow, purple, you know, whatever. We're all inclusive. And what this narrative is happening is that it's a hate movement made of good old boys who want to keep gaming culture the way it is. And a lot of people think, oh, we shouldn't care about gaming culture, except that it's this oppressive narrative, which is the same narrative that you and Brandon were just talking about. It's the same group
right.
of people. And pretty much we're being told that, one, any dissenting opinion must be silenced in order to keep their narrative. And two, any woman or minority or any other kind of minority figure who should, quote unquote, agree with these people, we don't count as people. We have to be silenced. They've compared, and I get this pretty much daily, we get compared to slaves that fought for the Confederacy, or we're told we have Stockholm Syndrome, or that we're sock puppets, or any other way to dismiss us as having our own voice because we don't agree with them. And we get death threats, rape threats, all these other threats, and it doesn't matter. They kind of block us, they ignore us, they pretend we don't exist. And we don't really care about those so much. Like, we're tough enough that we're not going to go out there and be a kind of like their figureheads constantly are going on mainstream media and saying, oh, I'm a victim of harassment and stuff. We don't go out there and do that, but it's frustrating when we get harassed just as much as they do, if not more, but they're acting like they're the only ones that get that way that they can control the narrative and say, oh, these other people are evil. And I actually had someone tell me the other day, and of course I've heard this multiple times, but the most recent was a couple of days ago when a guy told me that being a part of a hate group means that I'm basically should be given this treatment. And the only ones that call it a hate group are these people who are doing it as a get out of free card to harass us. And that's pretty much what happened here at Calgary Expo, is they claim that she was part of a hate group, that she was being harassing. They get to define what harassment is and therefore silence her and pretty much really, really hurt her career.
Yeah, and that's kind of what I noticed. And I actually, I tweeted about it earlier. And, I a few months ago, when we had Adam and Brandon Morris on the show, we were talking about the fact that the petition had gone out to because of the Gamergate stuff, and because he's just so mean to the girls on Twitter, that Adam Baldwin should be he should have his invite to SupernovaCon pulled. Right. You remember that when they were trying to get him uninvited from Supernova in Australia?
I remember all that.
And, yeah, well, so here we go. We've got this petition to get him removed, and they got something like 6,200 signatures. And, of course, you know, his fans turned around and got 6,500 signatures on a petition saying that they shouldn't take his invitation away. And then you get SupernovaCon involved. And they say, hey, we realize he's a controversial figure, and, you know, we were hoping that we could just have a conference and have it not be about politics. And guess what? They had Adam Baldwin's back. They did not rescind his invitation. And this was, they had plenty of notice ahead of time. They could have just said, hey, it would be better if you didn't come. You know, and they didn't.
Yeah.
They had his back when people tried to push him around. So what happens when the same thing happens to the Honey Badger Brigade and to Allison Tiemann specifically? The con doesn't back her up. Instead, they bully her until she cries. But, you know, equality or something. Because remember, this is all about bullying women, right? Except for...
Yeah. It's the other
when
side.
When it's a man accused of bullying a woman, they back him up. And when it's a woman accused of bullying, I don't know, everybody. I don't know. I don't understand how you can be on your back fighting to stand up and have people calling you the bully.
Yeah, and that's really
what it gets down to
is they hate the women more, it seems. It's like how they go after Milo, who he's a homosexual, and so they attack him more and harder because you're a homosexual. How dare you not fit the narrative? and they attacked me.
I get it too, to a lesser degree. You know, not necessarily. I mean, I'm kind of on the fringe of the gaming community. I have a lot of friends who are involved, but I don't really get it myself, and that's part of the reason that I really wanted to understand what was going on here, because, you know, we talked about it before. This actually affects everybody. Games are being introduced to kids as learning tools in elementary school. And if we have, you know, if not that the left doesn't have complete control of the education system anyway, but if they also have control of educational games, we have a problem, because guess who uses educational games? The private schools and the homeschoolers that they can't reach through the public school system.
Right.
And so then that gives them access to the kids they can't get through the public school system. And I think that's part of the reason they're fighting so hard for this, is that it gives them access to kids that they wouldn't otherwise have access to. And the leftist narrative doesn't work unless you get everybody.
Right, and they're spreading their tentacles pretty far.
Mm-hmm. And that's
a lot of people don't realize that these people who are attacking Gamergate, I'll take Anita Sarkeesian, for example. She has this feminist frequency. She's a very big name in feminism. Well, she has a deal with Intel that's, you know, multi-million-dollar deal. She also has a deal with Common Core, the people who create Common Core, and she has a lesson in Common Core about sexism in gaming. So it's one of those situations where you, like, wake up, people. Y'all need to pay attention to Gamergate, because what's been happening for decades about these progressives getting more and more control kind of subtly, well, they tried to do it with the gamers, and the gamers said no, which I know Brandon and Adam talked about on their last show where you talked about Gamergate.
Yeah.
And that's why so much of this is coming to light, and why it's such a more of a firework situation, because the gamers have defied them and they blocked them. So,
yeah.
But
How dare you tell us what games to like?
It's the gamers.
Yeah.
It's not just gamers. It's comic books. They about a month ago, there was a huge controversy with a Batgirl cover. Just recently, there was a controversy with the Hugo Awards, which is a sci-fi book. So they're trying to get in every orifice they can, attacking what I call, like, nerddom, the nerd culture. And there's a lot of nerds. People are surprised at, you know, even closet nerds are being attacked. And they attack casual gamers. Like, you're the guys on the football team who still like to go home and play Madden. Those guys are being attacked too, and they wouldn't even call themselves gamers. They just like football games or something on the Xbox. So everybody's being affected, and people don't even realize it. And this, it's a young demographic that's being attacked majority. I mean, I wouldn't consider myself a young demographic, unfortunately, anymore, but it is a huge young demographic that's being targeted, and they're being told, you have to think this way, otherwise you are a horrible human being. And, I mean, they're lumping these Gamergate supporters. I mean, I'm being lumped with ISIS. I've been lumped with...
Right.
I've actually been personally compared to Hitler. I have been compared with, oh, my goodness, pretty much the KKK. Joss Whedon compared Gamergate to the KKK.
You know, I would really love it if he would just stick to directing TV shows and stuff, because he does great TV. I'm not gonna say that he doesn't, but I don't think that politics is his strong suit.
No,
you know, maybe that's just me. Maybe that's just me. But no, you've interacted with my husband on Twitter. You know kind of how he thinks, and a lot of times we think the same way. And his first question was, you know, when for the people who say, you know, well, Gamergate doesn't affect me, you know, why should I care about this? He's like, if you want to know why should you care, ask yourself, why do they care? the leftists that are trying to take over the gaming community and to influence it and to drive it in a certain direction, why are they doing that? Because when you figure out why they want to control what you get to see, that's how you figure out why you should care what they're doing. I mean, it's the same thing. I've had the same argument on the Second Amendment. Somebody says, well, you know, why do you need an AR-15? How do you benefit from taking it away from me? Why I need it?
Right.
It's the same argument, you know. And I think that, you know, a lot of people don't really notice that, you know, because, like you said, the people that don't consider themselves gamers, or, well, I don't have any connection to the gaming community, or, you know, well, whatever, that doesn't affect me, or I don't have kids, that's not going to affect me. Well, eventually it might. And not only eventually it might because you might have kids, eventually it might because these kids are going to be the president probably while you're still alive. You know,
right.
So it's not, you can't discount something that covers that much of the culture. And that's why, ultimately why I decided that I needed to get involved. And obviously at the periphery, I haven't really kind of immersed myself in everything. And I'm sure if I made an announcement about, you know, what I was paying attention to, they probably wouldn't want to let me into Comic-Con either, but I keep going anyway. So, yeah.
Yeah, and it's actually kind of sad because a lot of us are afraid after this. We had a discussion about fear for, you know, when we go to Comic-Con, will we be kicked out for supporting, or will somebody recognize us? You know, my face is on Twitter, and will they be like, hey, that's
right.
Ashley Phoenix, and she's a horrible human being. She's literally Hitler. Let's kick her out. And, you know, will that happen while I'm standing there next to my mom? It would be horrible. So there is that fear. But when people say this doesn't affect them, like you said, that was a very good point. The other point I have to make is, it's called Gamergate, but it's really an attack on all nerd culture. And we don't think of nerd culture if we're not classifying ourselves as nerds. But let's think about some of the most popular TV shows right now. Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.,
mm-hmm.
Gotham. The most popular movies are a lot of these Marvel movies, the Avengers movies. You
right.
walk into the Disney store, you see Star Wars. So nerd culture is all around us. We're visually being influenced by it. And what
well, look at the
want.
Doctor Who fandom that has sprung up in the United States. I mean, who knew that was going to happen?
It's everywhere. People have to face that it's everywhere. It's being attacked, and they're using it to manipulate for their own benefit. And people need to see that.
Yeah. Well, and I obviously I'm working on a follow up article too. I've got two up at DanaRadio.com. I've got the first one with the link to the interview that we did with Brandon and Adam a few months ago, and then there was a follow up, I think a couple like a week after, where I actually talked about the Anita Sarkeesian and the tie to Common Core.
Right.
The lesson that she had, we actually had screenshots of some of the lesson plan, and so that was up there. And I noticed something today. I went back doing some research for this next article, where we were talking about the petition to get Adam Baldwin banned, and then the petition to keep them there. Well, for the first time, I went back and I looked at the comments. And these are comments that have only been posted within the last 4 or 5 days. Now, if you remember, these petitions were before SupernovaCon, and that was in February, wasn't it? Wasn't the con in February?
Yeah, I think.
I mean, I'm pretty sure it already happened.
Yeah,
I'm pretty sure that it, because we did the interview with Adam in January, and that was I think the con was coming up maybe within a couple weeks of that, and I was looking at the comments, and underneath there was one that was labeled Anita Sarkeesian. Now, I realize you can sign in as anybody you want when you do this. And it says, I really, 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 really can't stand Adam Baldwin. he's a big meanie. I'm like, okay, well, that may or may not actually be her. I wouldn't be surprised either way. But then the next comment said Adam Baldwin. I know, I was really mean. I'm so sorry. I have severe autism, LOL. I'm like, are you kidding me? So now not only are we going, I mean, do we really need to bring that into it? I mean, it's like, I don't even know how to not be angry at that, because what you're saying is, okay, autism makes you stupid, and it's an excuse for being an asshole. No. I'm sorry, but no. You know, my stepson,
I can tell you that is a Chan board culture thing.
Yeah. My stepson has a half brother who is autistic. And so it's very close to home when people talk about that. And of course my mom thinks I have Asperger's, but that's because I talk too much and I don't pay attention when, you know, people want me to shut up. So I don't think that has anything to do with anything else. I think that's just, you know, my mom telling me I talk too much. But just that they would use that kind of language. I mean, obviously it wasn't actually Adam Baldwin who said it, because just no. But I don't understand. Why would you even go there? I mean, these are the same people who want to ban the word bossy because it's offensive and,
yeah.
You know, really? But we're going to use autism as an insult and an excuse to be, you know, jackasses. Okay, that's not how this goes. I don't know. It's just, I'm really kind of interested to continue following where this goes, and not because, oh well, you know, there's going to be a show every weekend, because obviously that's happening, but it's just, I want to see, I really have enjoyed watching the gamers fight back, and I don't know enough to jump into it very often, but when I do, I've noticed how quickly they turn on me too. And, you know, having been a, you know, the lone conservative female in a lot of rooms, I don't mind being a lightning rod occasionally. So, you know, they throw stuff at me, and my mom, bless her heart, is one of those people she's very sensitive. She's a people pleaser, and she's got she's got a master's in counseling, and so she really wants everybody to feel good about themselves. And so when I tell her, oh, well, somebody said this about me on Twitter today, she's like, how do you stand it? I'm like, well, considering I don't value their opinion, it really doesn't make all that much difference. And she's like, well, how does that not offend you? Well, I don't care, so it doesn't offend me. And so it's kind of, it's interesting to have that conversation. But I'm kind of with you, you know, if you're concerned with, you know, being attacked or kicked out of Comic-Con when your mom's right there, I think I would feel differently if my mom was going to be in the room with me. But most of this stuff happens via social media, and my mom doesn't even have a Facebook account, so she's not even going to see it. And so, you know, she hears about it, but only from me. And so, you know, she gets vicariously offended every once in a while, and I think it's good for her, because, you know, somebody's got to raise the blood pressure once in a while. But I don't. But otherwise, you know, it's interesting, because, you know, Jim's right there, and a lot of times he sees it and he's like, oh, who'd you piss off today? I'm kind of used to it. I mean, some of it's just my personality, that I don't get easily offended by stuff like that. And part of it is, you know, spending 10 years in the military. You get used to people calling you, you know, a slug and whatever, you know, when you go through training there. I think I got long-haired coffeehouse crackhead once. But usually it was just, you know, stupid, move, you know. you kind of, it rolls off your back after a while. And and as I said before, these are people whose opinions I don't really value because they can't back it up with anything but more insults. I mean, if you want to have a discussion with me and you want to bring some information with you and say, hey, this is what's going on, you know, I'll have the conversation by all means. But if you're going to jump in and go straight for the jugular because that's the only way you can win, then I really don't have any interest in what you have to say. And any insult you can throw at me is just going to, you know, in one ear and out the other. I might laugh at it for a while because you probably spelled something wrong, but beyond that, no. I'm not going to give it another thought. I'm wondering, and, you know, we've been talking about politics and all that too. I'm wondering if any of the incoming candidates are going to address this kind of thing, not necessarily Gamergate specifically, but this idea that it's okay to bully anyone who doesn't embrace the narrative that you choose. You see it more in media watchdog organizations than you do from actual politicians. And I wonder if anybody is going to be brave enough to step up and say, hey, enough is enough. You know,
I only know not of one just, politician you know, who's you, even talked about this.
Who is that? Just out of curiosity.
My mind is going blank.
Sorry, who?
She started getting involved with this because one of her constituents is Brianna Wu. And so she's taking up the platform against Gamergate as Gamergate's a hate group and we should stop web hate. And Zoe Quinn, who, you know, the catalyst for a lot of this, went to go meet with her last week and they had a stop web hate campaign. And that backfired on them because they were doing this hashtag stop web hate. They were supposed to show examples of Gamergate harassing people. And instead, a lot of Gamergate supporters started using the hashtag and had screenshots of receiving tons of harassment. I mean, it was overwhelming what side had more harassment against them. And people who supported Zoe Quinn and this Stop Web Hate, they were like, oh, it's just been a ruined hashtag. And it's like, yeah, the truth hurts, doesn't it, of you know who's the real hateful. But this... I can't think, it's a representative up in Massachusetts, but she's been the only politician who's jumped on it to try to get more, definitely a PR stunt from everything I've seen. She's gained like 3,000 Twitter followers just from starting it.
I'm looking at the hashtag and I'm not seeing, the name. You're popping up a lot. I'm just looking at the stop web hate.
Massachusetts Representative Catherine Clark. That's who it is.
Catherine Clark, okay. Huh. Well, that's interesting. Considering her, you know, this senator from... Now, is she a state rep or a U.S. rep, do you know? It'd be interesting.
I want to say, because I hadn't heard of her before, I think she is actually just
a state rep
representative.
Maybe. Yeah, I'm not
sure. She might be
her.
A U.S. rep. But.
Okay, well, that's interesting. I mean, I don't necessarily see a presidential candidate adopting it as part of the platform because, you know, ISIS. But, you know, it would be interesting to take it to one of the potential candidates and say, hey, you know, according to the left, we're as bad as ISIS. You may want to address this. I don't know if that's really the way we want to get attention, but that would be interesting to see what they would say.
I'm as bad as ISIS. Please don't escort me out of this congressional.
Right.
I can see that backfiring.
yeah, I could see that too. But, you know, what are you going to do? But that would definitely be interesting. What, actually, has anyone thought about putting together a Gamergate booth at CPAC next year?
We've had discussions about Gamergate boost, about Not Your Shield boost, which is the collective hashtag for
right.
the women and minorities that support it.
We
right. even talked about a Gamergate con, because the more we get...
That would be fun.
It's fun, but people keep suggesting I plan it, and I'm like, excuse me, what? I'll need help.
Well,
and money.
If you decide you want to take it to CPAC, this would get you, and it would definitely be interesting, because obviously it's a conservative political action conference. So, you know, Gamergate is pretty much, across the board demographic-wise, and CPAC is very much a conservative conference. But I think that because of the liberty that you're looking for in the gaming community, and just the idea that, you know, you... there are principles that you refuse to violate. Obviously, to me, it lines up perfectly with kind of a libertarian perspective. And a lot of the groups that come out to CPAC are more libertarian in nature. And so I think it'd be interesting because they do a lot of, culture type panels, and they don't really connect with the young people there. At the conference, like they have the youth outreach panel every year, and every year we laugh at it because the youngest person on the panel is like 40, and not that, I mean, I'm 36, you know, let's be completely honest about it, but it's one of those things where you want to reach out to young people, and you're giving us the same tired speech that we've had, you know, how many years in a row, and you're talking like at 40, you know something. And here's the thing. There are a whole bunch of, 17 to 25-year-old high school and college students running around this conference that could do a better job at what you're doing than you are right now.
Right.
They could tell you what the youth is looking for. They could tell you, what. And I think that It would definitely be interesting, because the last couple of years there's been a whole lot of controversy about a group that was like atheist conservatives, and because they weren't allowed to have a booth last year. And I actually talked to some of them, and they were there to promote atheism, not to promote conservatism. And so they were right to not give them a booth. Well, they had a booth this year, and I didn't really talk to any of them about it, but the people that were representing them last year should not have had a booth, and they were all protesting across the street with the table, and it was like the guys who sit out in front of Papa John's when they're getting remodeled and complain about unfair working conditions when they're getting paid more to sit there and wear a sign than the guy who's actually doing the work inside is getting paid. It's definitely interesting, and it's an interesting thought. I mean, if you decided you wanted to do a convention of sorts, that's something that I think would really resonate with a lot of people.
Right.
And I know I'd be interested, so there's that. And I'm one of those people who doesn't consider myself a gamer, so that's, I think you'd reach a lot of people with something like that, but I could be wrong.
A booth would definitely be CPAC. The Gamergate definitely
okay.
The supporters are libertarian. So, I mean, I've yet to meet
goodness.
A non-libertarian. So,
this is interesting. my producer, who you talked to when you first called in, he's asking me in private chat, can we have hot chicks and outfits like they do at Comic-Con? Head
yeah.
desk. First of all,
if there's a Gamergate con, I'm pretty sure I already have. There's a porn star who's pro Gamergate, and I know she'll be there and looking hot. So
well, there you go.
Them.
We'll bring porn star Tammy. Is that good enough? but be warned, for every hot
that
chick
works for
in,
me.
In an outfit. There is a morbidly obese electric blue Batman. I'm telling you, for for everyone. I'm not even kidding. That was the highlight of St. Louis Comic Con last year. was the electric blue Batman who probably should have been wearing a tent. But, you know, or the Batmobile, you know, if we had just built it around him, that would have been cool. I love Comic-Con. I love the atmosphere. I love the people. I love the people watching, actually. And not because I'm like, oh, look at that outfit, it's ridiculous. Although you do get a little bit of that sometimes, because there's always somebody who dresses as Lulu who really shouldn't. And you know how it is. There's always someone wearing the wrong clothes. And some of it, you know, you have to excuse it because it's fun. You know, they're doing it because it's fun. They're not doing it because they think they look hot or whatever. And, you know, and then there are some of them that obviously think they look hot and have missed the mark. But it's fun to watch. And we had a good time at St. Louis last year, and it was definitely an experience. That was my first Comic-Con, and instead of just attending it, I chose to work it. So
that was your first mistake.
I'll say it was an experience. What?
That was your first
mistake. Yeah, that was. Well, no, and it wasn't bad. I had a great time, and it worked out for everybody because my sister-in-law does a lot of cosplay, and you saw some of her work online. So she's like, oh, good, you have a booth. I have some place to put my stuff. Well, yeah, if you put it that way. And I jumped in head first because last year alone I did Wizard World in St. Louis and then C2E2 in Chicago. And then Wizard World in Chicago. Within 6 months, I did all three of them. And so that was, it was kind of a new thing. I have a great time, and I'm looking forward to doing it again. And every time I come back and rave about Comic-Con, Hanny makes fun of me because I'm a dork or something.
What?
And exactly. Actually, I kind of got into trouble writing an article yesterday because I'm not enough of a dork, apparently. Do you know what I mean if I talk about teachers shipping students? I'm sorry if I'm going off on a tangent here, but have you heard that before?
Yeah.
So you know, you're seating certain students together or moving them apart in order to either facilitate or disrupt relationships. And so what they'll do is they'll say, okay, you know, in some cases we're talking about teachers who are trying to bust up cliques or students that are disruptive if they sit together. We're going to separate these two, or I'm going to have these three people work in a group project together because normally they wouldn't be friends and we'd like them to broaden their horizons. And when they do that, you know what, I'm all for it. Please make kids broaden their horizons. Please teach them that sometimes they're going to have to work with people they don't normally get along with. I think that's great. You know, and if you need to separate these two because otherwise you can't teach anything, then by all means do it. But when it comes to, oh, I think these two are cute together, they should date. Please don't do that with my money. I mean, is there not enough to do as a teacher?
As someone who was
with
a teacher,
just preparing,
there is plenty to do.
I know. You complain about being overworked and whatnot, and yet you're taking the time to be matchmaker as well. And it was just frustrating. Anyway, the reason... well... So that would be the baby in the background. So the reason that I was laughing at myself about this is that somebody was telling me about all this, and I got in to do the research. Guess where all the research is? Tumblr. Guess who's too old and not dorky enough to have a Tumblr account?
That's a good thing. That's a good thing.
Oh, I know. My sister-in-law, she alternates. she alternates between laughing at the idiocy and, you know, wanting to beat her head against the wall. So sometimes Tumblr's hilarious, and the rest of the time it just makes her ill. And so I'm glad that I don't do it. And I don't really want to have an account, but I did have to read a lot of posts to get information for this article. And what I found was interesting was that the teachers who admitted to doing this, like to putting students together for romantic reasons, they were doing so because the students had asked them for help, and these are students that spend more time with their teachers than they do with their own families, and you have to understand that. Like, no, I don't have to understand that we have a society that gives teachers more influence than parents. I have to correct that problem. I don't have to understand it. So let's hit the problem, because the problem isn't a teacher who's willing to help a student who comes to her for advice. You know, she says, "Well, I have a crush on so and so. What should I do?" Well, yeah, they're gonna answer the question. If they're a good teacher, they're gonna facilitate at least an advisory relationship with the student, and so they might give them advice or say, you know, maybe you should, whatever. But if they're using that as an excuse to play matchmaker with a bunch of little, you know, teenage puppets, it's frustrating. But the real problem isn't the teachers. The problem is the fact that we've convinced the teachers that they have this much power over our children. And we've convinced our students that, too. And so that's, I think that's where the real problem is there. But, you know, I like to get off on the whole tangent thing. But we've already run over by like 20 minutes. So I think I'm going to go ahead and wrap up the show, since I'm just babbling now. And, okay, so I'm looking at the chat, and Chow says, "Tomorrow on Media Matters for America, Virginia Cruda calls teenagers puppets." Bring it, Eric Bollert, is all I have to say about that. Oh, wait, he can't. He blocked me. Man. I've been blocked by, like, maybe 3 or 4 people, but of the 3 or 4 of them, Eric Bollert, Media Matters for America, he's kind of hilariously stupid. But, yeah, Roseanne Barr blocked me too, and so did Keith Olbermann, but that's because I told him he was irrelevant. So he proved it by blocking all interaction from me. Yeah. Anyway, well, thank you, Ashley, for coming on tonight, and it's definitely so much going on with Gamergate and all of the people who are connected with that. There is a whole community of libertarian and conservatives who, I think if they knew what was going on and really, really were paying attention to this, I think they'd be behind you. And I think that's what we need to be. We should be focusing on talking to, I would even say, start tweeting elected officials and say, "Hey, this is going on in America. People are getting bullied for having opinions and for voicing opinions." And I think they know that to an extent, and they see stuff like the war on women, and they know that it's not the conservatives perpetrating that, and they understand that. They understand the idea, but I don't know if they understand just how far it's gotten into the gaming community. And I think that's something that we could really help draw attention to. So that's just a thought. In any case, I will probably have an article up sometime tomorrow or Wednesday, follow-up talking about the stuff that went on at Calgary and some of the stuff we talked about tonight. And it was great to have you on and finally talk to you.
Anytime.
So, yeah. Well, yeah, because, you know, we've been back and forth on Twitter a few times, but this is the first time that we've actually had a conversation, and definitely some interesting stuff coming out. So All right. You guys have a great night. Hammy, do you have anything that is coming up this week?
Yeah, we've got on Wednesday night, we've got the Red Wine with Jody and Di. They'll be on. And then in 2 weeks after Right Online, we'll be back with Getting Hammered.
Okay. Well, sounds good. Are you going to Right Online?
I will be there.
Ah. I should have done that. I got some email about a free hotel room or something. Anyway. Maybe next year. All right. Let's go ahead and cue the music, Hammy. And everybody have a good night. Miss Ruth, thanks for hanging in there. I know the noise was rough on you. But have a good night, everybody, and we will see you next week.
I met the captain Farrell and his money he was counting. I first produced my pistol and I then produced my rapier. Stay and stand and deliver, for you are a bold deceiver. A shuddering out of new Adam Duff. Whack ball the daddy-o, whack ball the daddy-o.